Today, we are continuing our study of the Bible Correspondence Course, Lesson 12, the second part of Lesson 12, which is about the Feast Day of Atonement. And we begin with the third question in that study, which reads, was the Day of Atonement kept in the New Testament, and will it be kept in the future kingdom? We'll begin our study with looking at Isaiah chapter 2, verse 1, that reads, the word that Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Okay, we see here that Isaiah saw the word of Yahweh. He was a seer, a prophet foretelling future events, as detailed by the words that he wrote next. In chapter 2, verses 2 through 4, we read, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain, and the word mountain there is literal, but also figurative in the sense that it means governmental strength and permanence. So Isaiah is speaking, hearing from Yahweh, saying, now shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills. This implies that he is going to establish a government greater than any other government and even the lesser powers. And all nations shall flow to it. I looked up the word all, and it means all. Many people shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the Elohi of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. This is an amazing prophecy. The word Zion refers to the established kingdom after the Messiah comes and after the thousand-year reign. And it's saying that that Yahweh's law will be essentially the law that the Messiah will rule by in the thousand-year reign, and that there will be peace. And Yahshua, through Yahweh, will be the judge of the nations and of the peoples. In verse 5 of Isaiah 2, we read, O house of Jacob, referring to basically all of Israel, come and let us walk in the light of Yahweh. And of course, walking in the light means walking in the way, in the law, in the will of Yahweh. Now, another book, the book of Micah, provides a second witness to this prophecy. And it is debated among scholars whether it was actually Micah's words that were used by Isaiah in this parallel prophecy. Not to say that he plagiarized Micah, but this was the same prophecy given to Isaiah as the one given to Micah. In Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, we read, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of Yahweh's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and peoples shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the Elohi of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And this is a prophecy that a lot of people want to use to justify using the Jerusalem time as the time of when the feast days are set. But this prophecy refers specifically to the latter days. And we here at Yahweh's Assembly in Yahshua believe that we need to cite the new moons for each month, and especially for the Day of Trumpets, which is a key day in the latter days. Micah, staying on chapter 4 and looking at verses 4 and 5, we read, "But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. For the mouth of Yahweh of hosts has spoken. For all people walk each in the name of his Elohim, but we will walk in the name of Yahweh, our Elohim." And the words there in Hebrews, Yahweh Elohenu, which means our Elohim, forever and ever. A little bit different than in the book of Isaiah. And he's also, I believe, referencing the Messiah, who is the one who is speaking to all of those who hear the words of Yahweh, including Moses, Adam and Eve, King David, all the prophets, and us today. We are hearing the word given to us through Yahshua, the son of Yahweh. And that's indicated by the phrase Yahweh of hosts, Yahweh of troops, Yahweh of the army. And we also look at Joshua when he was met with a commander of the army of Yahweh, basically who led the Israelites to take down the city of Jericho. In Ezekiel 44, verses 23 and 24, we read, "And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In controversy, they shall stand as judges and judge it according to my judgments. They shall keep my laws and my statutes in all my appointed meetings, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths." That word there for Sabbath is the Hebrew word shabtotei. Of course, Ezekiel is speaking about the latter days as well. The law will exist then. And doesn't it make sense that we would keep the law now? Of course, that is true and will always be true. The law of Yahweh exists in the beginning when Yahweh created it, and will continue to exist throughout time. Going several chapters back in Ezekiel to chapter 20, verses 19 and 20, we read, "I am Yahweh, your Elohim. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them. Hallow my Sabbaths, and they will be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am Yahweh, your Elohim." So clearly, if we worship the Elohim of Israel, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, we need to keep Yahweh's Sabbaths, not just the weekly Sabbaths, but the high Sabbaths of his set-apart times, times which are basically pointing to the Messiah and the plan of salvation. Going back to Ezekiel, moving forward past chapter 44 into chapter 45, verses 16 and 17, we read, "All the people of the land shall give this offering for the prince of Israel. Then it shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings at the feasts." Now, the word feasts here is not the word moedi, which we find in Leviticus, but it's the word chag, which means celebration. And when we look at the word the prince of Israel, who is that? Who is the prince of Israel? Well, it's Yahshua. He is the one who is going to rule in the millennial kingdom with a rod of iron. And of course, he's going to rule by the law given to him by his father. And it also indicates here that that the feast days are going to be celebrated in that millennial reign. Yahshua will be the one who is directing that and overseeing the offerings. Then it shall be the prince's part to give burnt offerings, grain offerings, and drink offerings at the feast. The new moons, which is a phrase pointing to the annual day of trumpets, the only sabbaton that falls on a new moon. At the feast, at the new moons, the Sabbaths, and at all the appointed seasons, and that word there is Modi, which means appointed times of Yahweh, of the house of Israel. He shall prepare the sin offering, the grain offering, the burnt offering, and the peace offerings to make atonement for the house of Israel. In Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, we read, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder." Revelation 12, verse 5, "She bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up to Yahweh and his throne." It's a very short history of the Messiah. He was born, and at his death, he was raised from the grave and ascended into heaven, where he sits today beside his father and Elohim. Given these prophecies of the Messiah of Israel, by what law do we suppose he will rule? Could he rule righteously other than by the law of his father and Elohim, Almighty Yahweh? Impossible. In the book of Acts, chapter 27, verses 9 through 12. "Now, when much time had been spent, and sailing was now dangerous, because the fast was already over, Paul advised them, saying, 'Men, I perceive that this voyage will end with disaster and much loss, not only of the cargo and ship, but also our lives.' Nevertheless, the centurion was more persuaded by the helmsman and the owner of the ship than by the things spoken by Paul. And because the harbor was not suitable to winter in, the majority advised to set sail from there also, if by any means they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, opening toward the southwest and northwest, and winter there." The fast spoken of in these verses as a unique event is clearly pointing to the Day of Atonement. The fact that the crew and Paul were aware of the dangers of sailing before winter lends credence to the timing and nature of this significant, if not holiest, feast day. In connection with the character of this day, it may be that mankind will be surprised when they find out, after coming into the kingdom through horrific tribulation, they will then be expected to fast on the Day of Atonement. Question number 4. The world will eventually be at one-ment, which speaking it that way conveys the meaning of atonement, not just atoning for our sin, but actually a gathering of those of Israel. The world will eventually be at one-ment, on atonement, with Yahshua and our Heavenly Father. But how will this take place in the future? Again, looking at the book of Micah, chapter 4, verses 6 and 7, we read that, "In that day, says Yahweh, I will assemble the lame, I will gather the outcast and those whom I have afflicted. I will make the lame a remnant, and the outcast a strong nation. So Yahweh will reign over them in Mount Zion from now on, even forever." So again, we see this idea of at-one-ment and atonement. When Yahweh will assemble the lame, gather the outcast, he is gathering basically the house of Israel along with the house of Judah, as we read in Ezekiel chapter 37 and other prophets who tell of this event, this great exodus from all the nations to the land of Israel. Jeremiah 31, verses 27 through 28 reads, "Behold, the days are coming, says Yahweh, that I will sow the house of Israel and the house of Judah with the seed of man and the seed of beast. And it shall come to pass that as I have watched over them to pluck up, to break down, to throw down, to destroy, and to afflict, so I will watch over them to build and to plant, says Yahweh." In Ezekiel 34, verses 11 through 13, we read, "For thus says Adonai Yahweh, indeed I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out, as a shepherd seeks out his flock on the day he is among his scattered sheep, so will I seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day. And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries and will bring them to their own land. I will feed them on the mountain of Israel, in the valleys and in all the inhabited places of the country." It's amazing how the prophets have each heard Yahweh speak of this prophecy and how similar these prophecies are. It can only be given by Yahweh that we see the future. Does Satan, and therefore his influence, have to first be removed before all this happens? Well, let's read in Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 3. "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while." So the answer is yes. Satan will be sealed so that he cannot influence the nations. And we know that there will be people born and raised and marriage given, much like today, in that kingdom. They will be in the flesh, and their temptations will be not influenced by Satan, but they still will be of the flesh, hence the need for the feast days and offerings to the people there so that they can understand the workings of Yahweh and the sacrifice that is necessary to eventually be in the kingdom of Yahweh in the time past, that millennial time. Is the total destruction of Satan something that will eventually take place? In Hebrews 2, verses 14 and 15, we read, "Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he," speaking of Yahshua, "might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who, through fear of death, were all their lifetime subject to bondage." Of course, the bondage being spoken of here is the bondage to sin. We are in the flesh, and it's a result of the transgression of Adam and Eve to the law of Yahweh and to the specific command not to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. I believe that we were changed. Yahweh promised Adam that if he were to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that he would die in that day. And of course, a day to Yahweh is 1,000 years to us. So he, Adam and Eve, died less than one day, less than 1,000 years of age. Question number five. We know there are sabbaticals every 7 years mentioned in the Bible, and along with the sabbaticals is a jubilee year, the year following the seventh sabbatical year. Besides the sabbaticals, does the Day of Atonement signify when the jubilee year starts and ends? Leviticus 23, verses 26 to 27. And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Also the 10th day of this 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to Yahweh." And in Leviticus 25, verses 8 through 12, we read, "And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement you shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee, a year of release for you. And each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. That 50th year shall be a jubilee to you, and in it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine. For it is the jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field." Deuteronomy 15, verses 1 and 2. "At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debt. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called Yahweh's release." And what a relief that would be today if man were to abide by the law of Yahweh, and any debt that is owed, that it would be released. This is Yahweh's will, not the will of man. The will of man is to take, the will of man is greed, and the power of money, the power of control over one another. Deuteronomy 31, verses 10 through 13. "And Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the appointed time in the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, when all Israel comes to appear before Yahweh your Elohim in the place which he chooses, you shall read this law before all Israel in the hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and little ones, and the stranger who is within your gates, that they may hear, that they may learn to fear Yahweh your Elohim, and carefully observe all the words of this law, and that their children who have not known it may hear and learn to fear Yahweh your Elohim as long as you live in the land which you cross the Jordan to possess." Question number six. How is the Day of Atonement to be considered? Exodus 30, verse 10. "And Aaron shall make atonement upon its horns," speaking of the altar, "once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. Once a year he shall make atonement upon it. Throughout your generations it is most holy to Yahweh." And being most holy, we see the Day of Atonement to be, if not one of the most holy, the most holy day of the year. Leviticus 23, verses 29 and 30. "For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people." So atonement was a special covering for all the people, and for all their sins, which made it unique among all other days. This is why it's the most holy day. How often was an atonement to be made for the children of Israel? In Leviticus 16:34, we read, "This shall be an everlasting statute for you, to make atonement for the children of Israel for all their sins once a year." And he did as Yahweh commanded Moses. Was the one who refused to keep this day holy and humble himself cut off from the congregation? Well, in Leviticus 23, verses 29 and 30, we read again, "For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people, and any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people." I suppose we wanted to make that clear by repeating that verse. Question number 7, is Yahshua perfected in us when we are afflicted and physically weak? And for that, we need to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and look at verses 7 through 10. "And lest I should be exalted above measure by the abundance of the revelation," this is Paul speaking, "a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pled with the master 3 times that it might depart from me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness.'" Then it continues, "Therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities, that the power of the Messiah may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches." In other words, in people who basically, either physically or spiritually, attack him. "I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Messiah's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong." And this is a powerful concept that Paul is trying to convey. For it is really and truly only through our humility that we're able to understand the law of Yahweh, to bring ourselves into its submission. If we are proud and haughty and we do everything for our own benefit, for our own pleasure, how in this world are we going to humble ourselves and allow ourselves to be afflicted in this world, that Messiah might take control of us and do for us what he wants? Again, it's really only through our humility that this will happen. Question number 8, does the sunset of the 9th day of the 7th biblical month begin the Day of Atonement? And this, the question is being asked because many people being trained through current understanding of the calendar believe the day either begins at sunrise or at 12 o'clock midnight. The day biblically begins at sundown. So we want you to understand when a day begins, so that when we honor the days that Yahweh has given to us as holy days, that we're doing it at the right time. So let's look at Leviticus 23, verses 26 through 29 to begin with. "And Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, 'Also the 10th day of the 7th month shall be the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall afflict your souls and offer an offering made by fire to Yahweh. And you shall do no work on that same day, for it is the Day of Atonement, to make atonement for you," speaking to Israel, "before Yahweh, your Elohim. For any person who is not afflicted in soul on that same day shall be cut off from his people." And the confusion happens when people read about the 10th day. They don't realize that the 10th day begins at the end of the 9th day, at sunset on the 9th day. Leviticus 23, the same chapter, verses 30 through 32. And any person who does any work on that same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no manner of work. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generation in all your dwellings. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest, and you shall afflict your souls on the ninth day of the month at evening. From evening to evening you shall celebrate your Sabbath. Now, verse 32 describes how each day starts, that is, with the sunset. For example, Passover, held on the 14th day of Abib, would be observed from the sunset on the 13th and not sunset on the 14th, as many profess. Atonement is specifically a 24-hour period that starts when the sun sets on the ninth day of the seventh month. Atonement is on the 10th day of the seventh month. Question number 9, can the live goat, the atzazel, of the two goats listed in Leviticus 16 be related to atonement and the banishment of Satan? Leviticus 16, verses 20 through 22, speaks to this question. And when he has made an end of atoning for the holy place, the tabernacle of meeting, and the altar, he shall bring the live goat. Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of a suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all the iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. Revelation 20, verses 1 through 3. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal on him so that he should deceive the nations no more till 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. And we see here the parallel between Leviticus and the book of Revelation and the Azazel goat. Is it possible for the goat that was killed to be representative of Yahweh's son, Yahshua? And for that, let's go to Exodus 12, verse 5. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. This verse, we're looking at the idea that the sacrificial lamb, in effect, can be a goat. Leviticus 16, verses 6 through 10. Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. He shall take the two goats and present them before Yahweh at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for Yahweh and the other lot for the scapegoat. And Aaron shall bring the goat on which Yahweh's lot fell and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before Yahweh to make atonement upon it and to let it go as the scapegoat into the wilderness. In that same chapter 16 of Leviticus, moving down to verses 15 and 16, we read, "Then he shall kill the goat of the sin offering, which is for the people. Bring its blood inside the veil. Do with that blood as he did with the blood of the bull, and sprinkle it on the mercy seat and before the mercy seat. He shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions, for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting, which remains among them. in the midst of their uncleanness. So though a goat doesn't seem to be an appropriate symbolic representative of Yahshua, we should remember that a goat was an option for Passover when Israel was instructed to take from the firstlings. Going back to Exodus 12, verse 5, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year, and you may take it from the sheep or from the goats. We have now completed the series of discussion for lesson 12. The question remains, what have we learned? We have learned that the Day of Atonement is kept from the sunset of the ninth day to the sunset of the tenth day of the seventh month of the biblical year, whereas the Day of Passover is an atonement for us as individuals. The Day of Atonement is an atonement for us as the whole house of Israel. Its fulfillment is a day of affliction and a day of reconciliation to Yahweh, and because of this, it is the holiest day of the year. The difference between the sabbatical and the jubilee years from other appointed times is that they are counted from the Day of Atonement, which itself, like Passover, unleavened bread, the wave sheaf offering, Pentecost, trumpets, the first day of Tabernacles, and the eighth day are determined from the day of Abib in the spring. Atonement is the only appointed times in which we are required to fast, in essence, to humble oneself. Afflicting one's soul means neither working, eating of food, nor drinking water or any liquids. The Day of Atonement is for a 24-hour period of time. Only the high priest was allowed to enter the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, making atonement once each year for the children of Israel. The Day of Atonement is when a sabbatical year and a jubilee year begins. The Day of Atonement points to Yahshua's atonement sacrifice, and when we are made spirit beings who need no food. Historically, Satan was symbolically a goat cast away on the Day of Atonement. Keeping the Day of Atonement now, as it will be kept in the kingdom, foreshadows the time when the first fruit will be teachers having spirit bodies and require neither food nor water. Yahweh appeared on the mercy seat above the Ark of the Covenant on this day, and if the high priest came before the mercy seat at any time except on the Day of Atonement, he would die. And so, in conclusion, may we hold fast to our faith in Yahshua, keeping Yahweh's commandments until Yahshua returns, and we see, from the standpoint of our eternal frames, the judgment of the wicked and the gathering of the righteous into the kingdom of Yahweh and beyond. Hallelujah.